Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you're with us for another edition of On DoD, our weekly show focusing on challenges, opportunities, innovations, and just general happenings in and around the Defense Department. Today's show probably falls mostly in that innovations bucket. We're going to spend most of the hour talking about virtual worlds and how they're being used in the Defense Department and elsewhere in federal agencies. And a major effort there is centered at the National Defense University. My guest for the hour is Paulette Robinson. She is the Assistant Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at NDU's iCollege. Paulette, thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
So coming up next month, you guys are hosting a conference all about virtual worlds. We'll talk about some of the specifics of that conference and the agenda as we get through the hour. But talk us through, set this up for us, first of all. What are virtual worlds as far as how they're being used in government at the moment?
Well, virtual worlds are being used in governments in a number of ways. They're a way to interact in a 3D environment using an avatar, so you have a sense of being in the space. You have your own body to move around in. It's being used in productivity spaces for meetings and to take notes and collaborating on documents. It's mainly been used in the Defense Department with simulations and role plays. So the Defense Department has for a long time used 3D environments to practice different types of techniques. It's also being used for rapid prototyping to see different environments. It's being used for architecture so you can walk around a building, see how it could be used and how you want to have it adjusted. It gives a more 3D visualization. It's being used to model different types of environment like nuclear plants, that kind of stuff. So DoD is using it for a whole variety of things and testing. But their primary focus up until about this point has been in simulations and training and modeling. I see in the future 3D analytics will be more and more important with all the data that DoD has. And being able to walk through the data and interact with it in a different way. So the productivity part of it is going to grow.
Now, when I think about virtual worlds, my interaction with or knowledge of virtual worlds, I guess, goes back, I don't know, 6 or 7 years when things like Second Life burst onto the scene in the commercial space. Are we talking about similar type environments, or are we talking about even using things like Second Life, commercial software like that?
So the initial virtual world spaces that we've been started with Second Life, actually, in terms of that interaction, DoD had its own prescribed simulations and role plays. But Second Life, there's a whole military's in there, as well as they've created something like it's with an open sim, which is like Second Life. There's called Millands, which is a whole group from all across the military that have a space. And they have logins and that type of thing. So the speaker... There's a panel at the conference that's going to address that whole space, but they have avatars and spaces, and it's secure. The biggest problem for us in DoD, obviously, is cybersecurity. And security is really where we've been trying to focus on. Second Life needs hundreds of ports open, and DoD is not going to open their networks
sure.
That way. So finding enterprise versions of those types of worlds that work for DoD has been my goal for the last 5 years. In the last year, they've come out with a virtual worlds framework, the DoD Virtual Worlds Framework, that is open source, open standards, and they're going to talk governance at a workshop and at the conference. So how can we manage this so that not only DoD can use it across the space, but also the rest of the government?
I want to talk a lot more about cybersecurity as we get further into the hour, but let's talk about how the use of virtual worlds has evolved a bit. You've formed a consortium, I guess, at the iCollege, right, that goes back to 2007 or so.
Yeah.
That's a long time in technology terms. So what's changed since then?
So in 2007, there's five of us from four different agencies, NASA, the State Department, NOAA, and two of us from the iCollege. And it's now over 3,000 members that are from industry, government, and academia. The only way you can really do this is together. And so we want all these types of people in talking in the same room and evolving an answer for the federal government. So it has changed in that I think we have now reached a place in virtual worlds that the enterprise versions are more mature, and there's a place with budgets being cut, saving travel money, saving whole kinds of expenses, and still have people meet together, especially when you have a global environment. IBM uses virtual worlds, as much meeting space in virtual worlds as they do in physical spaces. Some of their teams never meet physically. So they save millions of dollars in travel and green costs in terms of buildings, that kind of stuff.
I mentioned Second Life and my first awareness of it going back to, I don't know, 2006 or so. My sense, and I have no evidence to base this on, is that in the commercial is probably the wrong word, but end user for recreational purposes, it's fizzled out a bit since then. Is it fair to say that virtual worlds have made inroads into government and in corporate settings as it's maybe fizzled out in those recreational uses?
Yeah, and so what's happened with the recreational sense is that unless there's something happening, there's no reason to be there. It's kind of boring. You want to run the space by yourself. Right. So many of those spaces have been event-driven. Now that they've incorporated productivity spaces where you can do live streaming, you can work on documents together, there's some interesting things Microsoft's doing with virtual worlds and integrating it into SharePoint. Dell's now considering how they're going to be using it. So it's becoming more of a workspace issue, not just a let's go in and play issue. As you know, the gaming world is making billions of dollars, but that's putting a narrative into place. So training and simulations will always be part of this. But I think the real win for government, especially at this moment, is saving a lot of money. Our little conference last year saved the government over $2 million because we streamed it so people didn't have to pay for registration. They didn't have to pay the travel costs of coming. So we had over 3,500 people attend our conference through virtual worlds in the stream.
That's phenomenal growth. Talk me through a little bit what you can do in a virtual world that you can't do through, I guess I'll call them traditional telepresence mechanisms, teleconferencing and webinars, that kind of thing.
So let me ask you a question.
When
you do, when you do a webinar, are you doing anything else while you're doing the webinar?
Almost definitely.
Yes. Typing, looking at other stuff, doing a variety of things.
Checking email, responding to email, you bet.
Do you feel engaged in that webinar?
Depends how interesting the content is, I think, a lot of times.
Most of the time, those webinars are really pushing information to you. It's not involving you in the information.
Right.
And so the important piece about a virtual world is once I'm in there, I feel my body moving and I feel engaged in the space as far as a physical being and not just sitting at my computer with other stuff to do. And when you're not working, your avatar takes a slump. So most people know that if you're not in the world interacting, that even if you're not talking, you're not there. But there's a whole sense of body interaction. And you're going to find the first day of the conference that, especially James Blaskovich is talking about infinite, he wrote a book on infinite reality with a professor from Stanford. And he talks about really how we really do believe ourselves to be there. The brain believes us to be in the space.
So your avatar goes for a slump. Everybody else can see your avatar slumping.
Right,
it's like being
right.
caught sleeping at your desk almost.
Yeah, that's right. Or in a meeting where you close your eyes and go to sleep. That it's more of an incentive to be part of it. But I actually think it's the understanding of being and being engaged in the environment in a different way than just sitting and listening to something, which is like listening to a video online for an hour, instructional video. Everybody
right.
wants to pull their hair out by the end because it's not, I don't feel myself engaged in that sense or having input.
And pulling that off, I imagine, is highly, highly dependent on how realistic you can make the environment, right?
Actually, that's not really true.
Really?
So I'll just give you an example. There's a virtual world called Snow World that was developed for children with burns, for burn treatment. It's very cartoony. It's got little snowmen. You can throw snowballs. And they're now using it in the Army for burn victims and soldiers. And they've done MRIs while they're doing in this virtual world, and it actually changes the brain. The pain centers in the brain change. So the brain believes itself to be there and is affected by what you do. So it's really very different and very engaging.
We're going to take our first break here, and when we come back, we'll talk a lot more about virtual worlds. But first, give us a quick plug for your conference, the where's, the when's, et cetera.
The conference is May 16th, 17th, and 18th. Workshops on the 16th, 17th, and 18th is the conference. It's at the National Defense University here in Washington. And we have a website that'll be posted, I'm assuming, on the radio
station.
Thank you.
Bet it will. And we'll talk more about the agenda as we go through here. Our guest is Paulette Robinson. She's the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the Information Resources Management College, the iCollege at National Defense University. Back in just a minute. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. Welcome back to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu, talking this week with Paulette Robinson, the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the iCollege at National Defense University. And she's very engaged right now in a conference that's coming up on virtual worlds that's going to be at Fort McNair at NDU coming up next month. We'll have more information on that on our website, federalnewsradio.com. And we're talking all about virtual worlds and how they're being used in DoD and across the government. And let's spend a little time in this segment, Paulette, talking about some of those case studies, some of those examples. Take me through some of what you think are some of the most interesting ways agencies are using these worlds right now.
Well, it's broad. At the moment, I would say that one of the interesting projects that I co-lead with the CIO from USDA, Chris Smith, who's now just leaving USDA, but we still have the project there, is called the VGov project. Mm-hmm. It is an attempt to create a virtual world space for all the federal government. It's located in a secure, in a data center in Kansas City, and it allows people to use the virtual world space in a secure environment with all those types of regulations that the government needs. We have four different virtual world possibilities on that contract. So anybody can take advantage of that contract. Doesn't have to go through contracting because it's already been done, which was an interesting process. And so there is ways to get resources in terms of content development. That's part of the contract. And so in that space, the Air Force has invested some money in creating Fort Sam Houston, which is the medical facility for all of DOD. Now they're transferring all their medical stuff there, and they're modeling the hospital and the area not only for orientation for people coming into the space, but they'll have training and simulations off of that particular virtual world space. So it's a real interesting kind of environment for the medical, because telehealth and telemedicine is becoming more and more important within DOD as well as the federal government. Another interesting thing that happened just this year, they used 3D Explorer off of the Federal Consortium site. The Department of Transportation this year had instead of sending many of their staff to a conference in Las Vegas that was on building bridges, so they had big equipment, that type of thing, they did a conference in the virtual world. And so the vendors came in and discussed what the different types of equipment. There were videos available because you can do streaming into these virtual worlds. And they had discussions with participants where they could have never had the discussions or been part of that conference. So it was a real interesting way to use a virtual world and save money for the government.
You mentioned that VGov concept that's running out of USDA. Is that kind of the primary platform that agencies are using right now, kind of a government version of Second Life?
Well, there isn't a primary platform in the VGov project. There's four. This just happens to be an environment to carry it.
Gotcha.
And I think that what's happening still with government, what they really need, and I think that's why the DoD virtual world framework is so important, is that it's going to be open source, open standards, which means we can then develop something altogether that we can share and not pay over and over for. So it's using common languages that are now available that weren't available before to use for 3D environments and where it wasn't goofy. So some of them were so flat and goofy, nobody really took them very seriously.
And what's the harder part of all of this? Is it building the platform and building the framework, or building the content, building Fort Sam Houston?
So the easiest part is the platform, quite frankly, although we have some issues with it evolving where government can use it, and that's what's been happening over the last 5 years. But the content's the expensive part, and government doesn't have up until recently, a repository that can hold pieces of content that can be reused. So we don't have to pay thousands of dollars each time we do a Humvee or a chair or a table.
And who's doing most of the work? Is it out on contracts? Is it people within agencies generally? Is it a mix of both?
It's a mix of both. I don't know if you remember when the web first came out, there to get a web developer was really expensive because nobody had the skills.
Nobody knew how to do it, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where virtual worlds are coming to. It's 3D modeling, scripting, and the tools are starting to get better where it's simpler. The Department of Energy has created a project called ENTER, N-T-E-R. It's led by Michelle Fox at the Department of Energy, and they have created a learning management system for the federal government. And they have community colleges in it and several other things. As part of Virtual Worlds, they not only have hooks into a virtual world so you can go out to a virtual world from it, but they have a simple 3D modeling tool that I could use because I am not a 3D modeler or a scripter.
Right.
But I could do it very easily using the tool they developed, and it's open source and open standards. So that's the direction it's going. Just like websites now are easy, you just can do them yourself.
Because the tools are there, they're built to make it easy.
Yeah. Right. Now it's maturing where the tools will be there for virtual worlds. That's what's kind of exciting. Once that happens, then it'll make a world of difference in terms of how these can be adopted. You don't have to have such highly specialized people, and it's not as expensive. The content is the key. There's a 3D repository being developed by the Department of Energy, and also the ADL Colabs has created a 3D repository. So now we have two aggregators of 3D content that we can use.
When you talk about open standards in this space, are these standards that are specifically tailored for virtual worlds, virtual world standards, or are they standards that have been brought in from other areas of technology, the web, et cetera, and applied to virtual worlds?
So it's the next extrapolation of the web, I believe. I think the web's going to have a 3D component to it. It only makes sense. It'll still have 2Ds, but just think, walking around the web, wouldn't that be cool to walk mm-hmm. around with somebody and look at stuff and interact? So WebGL is the language that is used for 3D modeling. That's the open source platform, and some JavaScript, and HTML5. So our phones are going HTML5 as well as the web. And that enables the ease of use for this more sophisticated media that's 3D.
So you interact with your virtual world with the phone that's on your desk?
But you know what? I just think of yourself. Of course, I'm getting older, so maybe I'm maybe a little cynical. But if you have a phone and there's little people walking around, you're probably not going to feel so engaged in that. But maybe some people will if you're younger and are used to that maybe.
Right.
But our phones will eventually be able to project them on walls or use devices, and those already have been created. It's just a matter of getting them to the point where they're in the marketplace and affordable. So I'll be able to project my phone onto a wall and interact in a virtual world on any space. When that occurs, and that's only, you know, a year or two away, it's not that far away, then we're going to find it real interesting. Just like the Kinect is another interesting way to interact with the world where you don't have to use the keyboard, you can just move your body, and that moves it right in the virtual space.
Right. You mentioned one of the problems with Second Life, et cetera, is that there's no reason to be there if there's nothing going on. So take me back. Let's use that Fort Sam Houston example. It's cool that you can build that and you can walk around a virtual Fort Sam Houston, but what do you do once you're there?
Well, they're going to create live training or group training. So what it'll do is meld people together around. They have so many people to train in the medical profession that what it allows them to do is do that training very efficiently and effectively and still do group dynamics. So it's not like do-it-yourself training necessarily. They probably have a few of those things, but most of it's to bring people together and bond them together in a workspace, give them practice like in a battlefield or practice in a particular setting so that when they have to do the real thing, they've actually have a body memory. That's the cool thing about virtual worlds. Because your brain believes you're there, you get a body memory of it, which is really powerful.
And from the user perspective, how do you typically interact with these government virtual worlds? Are you typing on a keyboard to talk? Are you speaking into a microphone? How are you moving your avatar around? Answer all those questions, if you would.
So the interaction in the space is in a variety of ways. So you can chat like with your keyboard. So you're like almost SMS if you mm-hmm. think about it that way. You can do it in group or individually. They have voice over IP, so it's just like using Skype or something else. You don't use Skype, but it has that capability
sure.
of just using headset and talking to one another. It's proximity based, so if you're farther away from someone, you don't hear them as well as when you're closer. So it gives that sort of sense of really environment. The body moves around. What is changing very rapidly. In the past, you have to use the keyboard, and I still use a keyboard because I haven't done Kinect yet. You can use a gaming device, but that's a mystery to me because I'm not a gamer. So what I'm excited about is the Wii has been adapted for these virtual worlds as well as now Kinect, because Kinect has development. So I have staff at the iCollege that are working on the Kinect so we can move and do gesturing and the body movements that are natural. And that's the key. One of the biggest stumbling blocks has been not natural interfaces for having your avatar move around. And so when your body is actually moving, you're more engaged and more transfer yourself into the space better.
You mentioned gaming, which leads to one of the questions I had. Is it a challenge at all to convince agency senior leaders who are going to have to buy into this, that this is not a video game, because it kind of looks like it, right?
Yeah. So what you have to do, well, yes, that's always been the first sort of, that's been the first hurdle, I would have to say. I think it's less of a hurdle now, but it always has been one in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, America's Army has been extremely helpful to the Army, not only recruiting, but also practicing skills, which has been a surprise to them, I suspect. But the virtual worlds, once they see that it can save them money, we can interact in terms of meetings and groups and actually have a productive space, and that the power and the research that's now showing about body transference and the changing of the brain in terms of practice, all of those things have now become more compelling. Where before it was just, well, they're just playing games. But now there's a lot of evidence and usage that you can show and show the effects of that it's becoming more compelling. I don't have that big argument that I always used to have at the beginning. No, this really isn't a game.
I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, but back to the user interaction with these virtual worlds. When you have an avatar in these government spaces, are you yourself, or do you have an alternate identity that's a fake you?
So isn't that an interesting thing? So I have an avatar in Second Life that I use. We do a variety of things in our four islands that we have. And it's got I've got designer suits and I have long flirty hair and I can wear heels. how I feel and look on the inside of myself. And when people see me, they automatically get that's who I am. Even if they see me in person, they kind of get that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Some people that I know have modeled themselves fairly accurately. There's even a professor who at our college that has sessions during his distance class in Second Life, and some guy came to a class at NDU and they came running to him and said, Professor Gravett, Professor, and he's going like, who is this person? But he recognized him from being in that space and having been had conversations and in that space. So it depends how you want to represent yourself. Certainly in the government, and this is one of the things our cybersecurity panel will address, is in the government you have to know and trust that that is the person that is there. Do they have to look exactly like themselves? In fact, there's been studies, if they look too much like themselves, it's creepy. So people are creeped out. So it has to be probably about 80% like you, but if you go to a certain level of likeness, people are creeped out. So...
But you're not an anonymous identity.
No.
Your name is Paulette Robinson.
That's right. That's right. Well, in Second Life, I'm Paulette Darkstone, because when I first went into Second Life, they wouldn't let you choose your last name.
Oh,
now they let you do that. But in a government setting, it has to be who you are.
Identity is crucial.
And what your credentials are. So I have to know, it's just like passing a business card. I have to know who you are and what you represent. And even more so, just think in the federal government, we had this environment where we could talk to one another and find each other. Well, I mean, there's nothing across the federal government that does that.
Right.
You have no infrastructure for it.
Right. Want to talk a lot more about cybersecurity, identity assurance, all those issues when we come back. We'll take our second break here. We'll come back with Paulette Robinson, the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the Information Resources Management College at NDU, the iCollege. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu, talking about the use of virtual worlds in government this week with Paulette Robinson. She's the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the iCollege at National Defense University. They're going to be talking a lot about virtual worlds coming up next month, May 16th through 18th, in a conference focused exclusively on this issue. And Paulette, this conference goes back quite a few years. You were mentioning how this consortium across government that focuses on virtual worlds has just exploded in size over the past few years. You've got about 3,000 people involved, I think you
said. That's right. We have over 3,000 members in the consortium that come from both federal government, academia, and industry. So we work on this all together.
And for people who might be interested in attending, let's talk about the conference itself. Tell me about some of the topics that you're going to cover and who you're going to have there.
So on the 16th is the pre-conference workshops. And these workshops are developed to go more in depth for individuals. And we're covering anything from 3D modeling and immersive types of data participation to creating virtual worlds education. We have telehealth in here, so not only PTSD, but advanced looking at telehealth. We have some some ethnography. We have gaming and simulation. So it goes a whole across the board in terms of the workshops. Things, there's something for everybody in the workshops. It's a single day, and we have tried not to put it too packed full so people have a chance to go and see what they want to say. See, probably for DOD, one of the important discussions is the DOD virtual framework. They're going to be discussing governance and how where to go next with the framework. They've got a beta test of a particular environment, so they're going to start with that, as well as the ENTER project, I think, will be of interest. That's by the Department of Energy. The Federal Virtual World Challenge winners, that is, the Federal Virtual World Challenge is by the Army, and the winners are going to be doing a workshop in terms of the types of tools they've developed for the particular challenge. So there's something for everybody. The communication convergence with Microsoft, Dell, and Polycom, what are they doing with virtual worlds, and how are they thinking about using them in their tools, is going to have a profound impact on what the government can do. So there's going to be a workshop on that in the afternoon. So it's a full day of workshops, so I think there's something for everybody.
And then following that, a full two-day conference, which is just, this is not a virtual conference. Well, it is a virtual conference for those who want to attend virtually, right? But you can also go in person.
That's right. So we stream the entire conference, not the workshops, but the two-day conference. And that's why we don't have people breaking off into sessions. We have one program so everybody can attend. One of our missions is to make sure people that want to be there, want to get the information, it's available. So we stream it and also bring it into 6 virtual worlds. And people at the conference can also watch some of the virtual stuff if they want to interact. We take questions from virtual and in the audience through Twitter as well as microphone. So we weave it together using Twitter, mm-hmm. and Facebook and social media. So the two-day conference is one of the best that we've ever had, mm-hmm. this year. It's been really exciting. I've been co-chair Randy Hendricks with me. He's going to be opening the conference this year. He is the CEO of 2B3D, and he's going to open up about the avatar and the convergence of all this communications now makes this possible for us to weave social media and a variety of things together to interact with each other in ways that we couldn't do it in the past.
So what else you got coming up in that conference?
So then the next speaker, so games do have a role in virtual worlds. Mm-hmm. If you think about them, they're like a theater set. So Jesse Schell, who is just an amazing speaker on games, thinks out of the box with games. And he's out of Carnegie Mellon. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be speaking about the future of virtual characters and how that's impacting in this convergence. Dr. James Blaskovich will be there. He's written Infinite Reality, and he's originally an endocrinologist, which is kind of interesting. And he's written this book he's done all this research on avatars and 3D environments and experiments. And they've discovered how we really do transform ourselves or transfer ourselves into these environments and how they affect not only us viscerally, but in the brain and change brain patterns. It's just absolutely amazing how it can have an effect. So he's going to talk about that type of environment.
That's so interesting. So your brain actually operates differently. You think differently in a virtual world than you would if you were interacting with people in the real world.
Well, and somewhat different, somewhat the same. So it's kind of like, for example, like I said, it'll shift pain centers. It can do that. It also is, you know, when people practice piano or tennis in their head, mm-hmm. they're still getting a visceral reaction. So their brain is actually changing and moving and growing and learning. So it has the same effect as if you're walking around in the environment. It's very closely patterned because the brain believes it to be true. But in Second Life, I can fly.
Right.
And I can have things that aren't physically occurring here. So we can actually model things or interact with data in ways is extrapolating from it and different. So one of the things I saw that I thought was just wonderful was a person standing and airplane data of an airport was being plotted by the use of just seeing airplanes. So the air traffic controller could stand inside this virtual world and see live data and the relationships of the plane in relationship to to their point in space rather than extrapolating it from a 2D environment. It was just really great. So there's some things that we can do that we can process information where now we feel overloaded by it and not see the themes with it.
You're also talking about cybersecurity, which I want to dig into. Tell me about that panel and what we'll hear there.
So the cybersecurity panel is in the afternoon of the second day. The moderator comes out of the University of Washington. She's part of the Center of Excellence for Information Assurance. She leads that effort. And we're really going to be talking not only about what does it take to have a virtual world in terms of security. How do you know who's logging in, that there isn't any kind of virus viruses or any types of things that could be introduced into the environment. But also they're going to explore the levels of identity, which hasn't really been brought up that much. So if I'm in a virtual world, so say we get to use virtual worlds across everything because I think that's where the web's going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I only want one avatar. I don't want an avatar for work and an avatar for this and an avatar for that. It splits sort of a split personality.
Right.
So, but the thing is that how you're going to recognize me will then be in layers of security, like our identity is now, if you think about it. I don't give you my social security number when I meet you, but if I'm in a personnel system that's going to be plugged into DoD personnel, they're going to need that information.
Right.
So the avatar is going to have layers of security, and that's going to be the next interesting and hard step. Once we get through the network protocols that will work for the government, and that's coming now with standards, that type of thing, the next step is really going to be, the hard step is going to be the identity of the avatar, because you want to make sure it's that person.
DoD is probably ahead of most agencies, I think, in terms of identity insurance and having that PKI-enabled CAT card, that you know, dual-factor authentication, single identity across the department. Is any of that being integrated into virtual world so far, or do we even want our real-world identities tied to our virtual identities
so this
in that way?
This part hasn't really been discussed. So I would imagine the first step the DoD will do is that they will have separate virtual worlds that you have to have a CAT card to get into. I mean, that's what the norm's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
For us at the college, and one of the reasons I got into this is I think this is the future of distributed learning and distance learning, that having aspects of this is what we need. But we have people from the State Department, and we have people from
right.
NASA. So the CAT card, since the government has still not been able to achieve
mm-hmm.
one single CAT card, one identity across government, just having the military CAT card won't work for us.
Right.
So I'm trying to find a solution for the whole federal government so we can just have classes in here. Sounds kind of bizarre, but that's the only way I could do it.
No, I know. That sounds like a huge challenge. I mean, might we have to evolve to just a separate identity mechanism that doesn't rely on these CAT cards or HSPD 12 cards? Is there going to have to be something different for virtual worlds?
Well, you know, there may end up being, what I'd really like to see, quite frankly, is a federal communications infrastructure that uses virtual worlds as a component.
Mm.
Where we have a profiling system where we can have discussion forums, we can have a variety of ways I can see your profile, so I know we have the same interest. Let's get together and have a discussion about this, work on common problems across government. That's what I'd like to see. And the identity may end up being biological. It might be fingerprints. It might be iris scan, because some of the biometrics are getting better and easier to use. We'll have to resolve how we want identity to work. I think we've danced around it for a long time, but the government, I think we're going to go in a different kind of direction with security, and virtual worlds just is going to have to be part of that overall for data. Just think it's a data. It's a data points. It just has three dimensions to it. So whatever data solution we have is going to have to be in the same with all the other data that we have in DoD or the government.
And another cybersecurity question on this, you've talked about some of the private infrastructure that DoD and other agencies are using, but you said you're also using Second Life, the public version of
That's
Second
right.
Life, it sounds like. And
That's
I guess,
right.
how are you getting away with that? I mean,
the only way you can do that is work at home, or, I mean, I can't remember the agency, I'll come to me, but they had to go to a coffee shop across the way because they couldn't use it within their agency,
right.
but they were still responsible for developing content. So if you want to interact with the public, it's free to use Second Life. You can get an avatar and you can go to events and it doesn't cost anything. So if we want to interact with the public, until we create a virtual world that is open source, open standards, that has a doorstep to the public, it's our best avenue for and venue to interact with the public.
Mm.
And it's a good place to experiment. So what's been happening is government didn't cost them anything except some money to develop content. So they've been experimenting. What can you do with these environments? How can we move with these environments? And that's been translating now into enterprise efforts.
Take one more break here, and we will come back for one final segment with Paulette Robinson. She's the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the National Defense University's iCollege. And we were talking today about virtual worlds in DoD and across government. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu, talking this week about virtual worlds, how they're being used in DOD and across the federal government, with one of the leaders in that space, Paulette Robinson. She's the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the Information Resources Management College, the iCollege, at National Defense University. And Paulette, just before we took that last break, we were talking about how people in DOD use Second Life, how they get into Second Life from a cybersecurity perspective, because obviously that's a public and open platform. We don't want to leave people with the impression that that's something that anyone in the Defense Department can do.
That's correct.
Really, we're in DOD, there's several of us that have labs that are accredited and certified but are off the grid and have permissions or have the ability to go and use a separate network. And so at the iCollege, we have a separate network. We can get into virtual worlds and experiment them on behalf of DOD for them to see what we're doing and see how it can be applied. So there's a number of us in DOD that do that, but none of us are in the actual DOD grid.
So we've talked a lot about during this show, a lot of the applications of virtual worlds, modeling and simulation, collaboration, virtual meetings. I mean, everybody's travel budget is under enormous scrutiny right now. One thing we haven't talked about too much is training and education, which you were telling me off the air is one of the biggest potential windfalls from this. Tell me how you see that being used and how it is being used.
So as we go more and more toward distance education, what virtual worlds offers us, rather than the webinar, just reading a web page, is mm-hmm. interaction in depth. So at the iCollege, we've used it in a number of ways. First of all, to make our distance learning courses where our students kind of get to know each other rather than just in messages and discussions. We used it for a formal debate, which went extremely well, where students worked very hard in getting ready. But we, in the real class, have an actual debate. But in the distance class, it was a little harder to do. And so Second Life provided a really neat platform for doing that kind of debate. If you think about Second Life as a stage, role plays and simulations are incredible. If they're very programmed, then the narrative is you go down branches of a particular thing. But what Second Life and virtual worlds allow you to do is create a stage, give people roles, and play it out. So if you're going to do a continuity of operations exercise, if you model the environment and have people actually go in and do the exercise, they learn where the holes and gaps are without it having to have travel where everybody has to come, or disrupting the actual day in a particular organization, and still find out where the team is not working together and where the gaps are. So it's a real important way to people work in unpredictable ways. And so Second Life and virtual worlds allow you very cheaply to create a set and actually have people do that. There's a big project called the I-95 project that's out of the University of Maryland that has all the emergency responders come to a scene of an accident, police, firemen, rescue, and no one ever knows what kind of their role is. This is a way for them to practice. And the state of Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and I think North Carolina, all of them have put money into this project because it's worth for them to work on teams.
And conveniently, they don't have to shut down I-95 to do it.
That's right. Also, telehealth is becoming really important for education. I mentioned the Air Force project, but Kevin Holloway with T2, which is telemedicine and technology, has done a project for the Army for PTSD, and we all know what a crisis that's been. And this island is for families and for vets and for people already that are serving to come and find out more about it. They have games and exercises that help sensitize them and give them resources, direct resources. They've created mobile apps that reinforce what they're doing. So it's a real important educational piece that then will go into a treatment piece.
And that was another thing I wanted to talk about with you. I think there are several applications in DOD where virtual worlds are being used for wounded warrior purposes. How does that generally work? Is it just a place where wounded warriors can interact with one another? Are they accessing care via the virtual world? Or
so the care piece is being carefully moving toward that piece, because it was interesting. In Second Life, the veterans have gotten together on their own. So you can walk around and do things when you're a vet that you've been injured, you maybe not be able to do. But that wasn't sponsored by the VA. That was vets getting together themselves. What the T2 project is really focusing. Kevin Holloway, the head of this particular part, is a psychologist. Most soldiers can't get care from PTSD if they're out in the rural areas or not near a VA hospital. What this is going to allow is a small pilot project where they're testing it in terms of being able to do actual treatment. And that's what's really needed, a way for people to feel safe. So in a virtual world, while your body and mind are have a sense of being there, you still have a little bit of removal and safety. So it's going to turn, it'll turn out to be really interesting. They're using virtual worlds now. NIH has put some money toward it in terms of drug rehabilitation and drug groups meeting in a virtual world. So I think we're going to see more and more virtual worlds taking on some interesting treatment roles. And with telehealth now being one of the places government is spending money, that in cybersecurity, you're going to, I think you're going to see some more and more interesting uses of virtual worlds.
A whole lot more information about virtual worlds and how they're being used in the federal space coming up May 16th through 18th at Fort McNair on the campus of National Defense University. We'll link to more information about that consortium, the fifth annual, at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Paulette, thanks so much for coming in today. It's been really informative, really interesting. Really appreciate your time today.
It's been a complete joy. Thank you very much.
And Paulette Robinson is the Associate Dean for Teaching, Learning, and Technology at the Information Resources Management College, the iCollege at NDU. This has been On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any of this interview, visit us online, federalnewsradio.com, to hear this show or any of our past shows. I'm Jared Serbia. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.